Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show, Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. Boris Johnson's going to war, but at least this time not on his own MPs. He's announcing an extra £16 billion for defence. But is this a good idea? Where do the threats come from? And should we be worried about autonomous military robots rising up against us? I've been speaking to Sir David Lidington, former cabinet minister, now head of the RUSI defence think tank. He'll tell us where the threats are coming from and whether or not we should be worried about the robots rising up against us. But first, it's our columnist panel. So it's Thursday, so we kick off with Robert Crampton and Esther Webber.
So, what to do about Jeremy Corbyn? I think we had, you were on, Robert, was it two or three weeks ago when that report came out? It only just come out about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party.
Yeah, it was three weeks ago, the East Equality and Human Rights Commission, yeah.
And it's now, he was suspended from the Labour Party for suggesting 19, that...
19 days, yeah.
The number of the cases have been exaggerated for political purposes. And then this week, the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party let him back in as a Labour Party member, but Keir Starmer won't let him in back as a Labour MP. He's obviously tried to draw a line under it, but it just doesn't feel like a riot that's going to go away.
No, nor should it. I mean, Starmer needs to take on the NEC now, I think. The readmission has been expedited far more quickly than it should have been. There's a sexual harassment case with Esther Wood. Know more about than me, but it's a sexual harassment case that's been waiting for 3 years, I think. He gets his hearing in 19 days and gets readmitted with a slap on the wrist and the minimum punishment, which is, I mean, it's back to square one. I mean, Starmer said that he's the first thing he wants to do was to reassure the Jewish community that anti-Semitism was not rife in the Labour Party, and he signally failed to do that. If he accepts the NEC decision, he needs to have a showdown about this. It's a good subject to have a showdown on, and he needs to take them on.
And I suppose, Esther, the there's obviously the issue of anti-Semitism, which is absolutely crucial to Keir Starmer showing that he's moved the Labour Party on. But to people who just didn't like the idea of Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party, wouldn't vote for Labour while he was there. Actually, Keir Starmer having a big ding dong about keeping him out of the Labour Party is quite good politically, isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of shows he means business. He said he was aware he would be judged by his actions rather than his words. And that's the kind of guiding philosophy here that, okay, we've heard enough of kind of warm words about sorting these problems out. And he did take quite strong action yesterday, and you know, for all the talk we heard from him, particularly during the leadership campaign, if anyone can remember that far back, he was talking about uniting the party And it just doesn't really seem like that is possible right now. And he had to pick a side, and he's chosen to monumentally annoy the left of the party, and that is the battle he's going to have.
Yeah, and I was struck, there was some YouGov poll, and there's sort of this snap poll yesterday asking, was he right not to reinstate Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour MP? 50% of people said he was right, 21% said he was wrong, and the rest didn't know. Interestingly, amongst Tory and Lib Dem voters, far more said he was right, but only 38% of Labour voters said he was right, 32% wrong. So it's all sort of slight dividing down on party lines on this. But then I suppose, Robert, what Keir Starmer needs is people who voted Tory last time rather than people who voted Labour. Although he needs
yeah,
to hang
he does.
To them
I mean,
well.
that poll worried me slightly. That only 38% of Labour members think he was right to readmit him or to allow his readmission. That worries me. But yes, it's the other people. I mean, that won't presumably influence their vote. Whereas for floating voters, undecided, I think this will be an issue. It's a question of it's not a Westminster bubble story. I don't think it's a story about the soul of the Labour Party. And as I said 3 weeks ago, it's an absolute entry level requirement for any political party, particularly perhaps the Labour Party, to not discriminate against people. And to let Corbyn back in. I mean, he said 3 weeks ago that he thought the whole business had been overstated, and now 3 weeks later, just in order to get back in, he says it's not overstated. I mean, you kind of know what he believes. And there's uniting the party, but there's also leading the party, and that's what Starmer has to do. And if that means upsetting some unpleasant people who think that a bit of anti-Semitism is okay, then so be it.
And yeah, I suppose every leader sort of looks at what became known as the Clause 4 moment when Tony Blair changed the Labour constitution. But a big thing which signals, as Keir Starmer likes to say, we're under new management, Jeremy Corbyn seems to have handed it to him. So just explain what this actually means in practice about having the whip. Ray's just messaged in saying Jeremy Corbyn should have the whip back, then he could do what he always does and just ignore it. So what does it mean to have the Labour whip?
Yeah, it is a fair point that Jeremy Corbyn has never set great store by voting with his party before he became leader. But it means he will officially sit as an independent within Parliament, and he can't be part of kind of party meetings or discussions. And he's not formally included in all those kind of resources and access to the party that would normally be his entitlement as a Labour MP.
And do you think this will have a long-term impact, Robert, in terms of the politics? And, you know, because on the one hand, Keir Starmer's showing some leadership, some would say, and he's distancing himself from the previous regime. But on the other hand, divided parties tend not to win elections.
That's true. So he needs to unite it. But uniting it might mean some people having to leave.
Yeah.
I mean, that's coming.
In a way, he'd probably rather have this fight now in an early stage of the parliament than in 2 or 3 years' time when we're talking about an election again.
And is it possible, Esther, that if this does drag on all the way to the next election, that Jeremy Corbyn, then he won't be able to stand, would he, as a Labour MP?
I think that's right, yes. And, I mean, that would be a change in Islington North. It'd be interesting to see if he actually takes anyone with him, because so far, we've heard a lot of kind of fire and brimstone from his supporters, but no one's actually kind of throwing in the towel to go with him, apart from one former Labour MP who only the most kind of political geeks will remember.
Remind us of her name, because I must admit, when I saw this story, even I'd forgotten that she was an MP.
Sorry, that would be... I can't believe, Matt. That would be Thelma Walker, of course.
Oh, of course.
As everyone knows.
Yes.
who used to be an aide to John McDonnell when he was the Shadow Chancellor. So she said last night she was quitting the party because she was so upset about what's happened. So it hasn't really brought out the big names, as you might say, but it could be they're keeping their powder dry for now, deciding what to do next. And the big question will be about Len McCluskey, I think.
Sorry, Esther, I interrupted you.
No, go on, Robert.
If you were a sensible kind of thinking member of the so-called hard left, say if you were John McDonnell, for instance, you would not want to have this battle, would you? Because what do you end up defending anti-Semitism. So that's precisely why Starmer should have this battle.
Yeah, and actually that was one of the things that John McDonnell and Corbyn did fall out about during their leadership was the failure to tackle anti-Semitism. I think you're right. I think Esther, you're being a little bit harsh on Jeremy Corbyn supporters. I mean, they've got a petition and a Twitter storm. So I mean, they're really pulling out all the stops.
And they might have an online rally or something as well. Yeah,
and a certain number Excuse of MPs me. Have also pitched in, haven't they?
Yeah. And they've written a letter as well. So that's really, there's no way that Keir Starmer could come back from this. Right, Esther, let's talk about the story, which is on page 2 of the Times today. The number of people contacting Parliament's bullying, harassment and sexual misconduct helplines fell by more than half during the lockdown in the spring, according to new official figures. What have you found out?
So there is now an independent complaint system in Parliament, which people who work there can use if they feel they're being subjected to any kind of inappropriate or bullying behaviour. And what these figures that were released yesterday show is that the number of people contacting the helpline fell dramatically during the height of the national lockdown in the spring. And on one level, that kind of seems intuitive, doesn't it? If you're not in the office, it's less likely you're going to be subject to bullying behaviour by your boss. But it is quite a big fall, and that kind of is actually fell by more than half. And that kind of shows how intensely the problem is associated with actually working in Parliament and working in MPs' offices.
Do you think, I mean, we've talked a lot about how coronavirus and the lockdown has changed the way we live and the way we work. Do you think this might have a permanent impact on the culture in Westminster?
I think it's possible. Yeah, I think more so than any other workplace, and possibly for understandable reasons, there is a kind of adulation around the actual building of Parliament, and people set a lot of store in the importance of being there. And maybe this has shown it can be a bit more flexible, and it's possible for staff in particular, so not necessarily MPs, but definitely for staff to work in different ways. On the other hand, I've also heard from some staff members who say their bosses have gone completely the other way, and because they've maybe got a bit more time, they've done nothing but kind of pester their staff and get on their case. So I think it can cut both ways. I think a little less kind of reverence around the building is probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, Robert.
It shows it must be a really toxic place to work, where in order to avoid being bullied, you have to not go there. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I mean, okay, and it's fallen from 87 complaints to 38, but 38 is still a hell of a lot. I mean, I think somebody made the point on your Twitter feed that if that was any other organisation, there'd be, you know, there'd be serious repercussions. You'd think that was a really dysfunctional company, wouldn't you?
It's the other thing that was in this report is that 9 complaints were upheld last year, but under the rules, we won't know what any of them are.
That was news to me. I mean, that's
slightly mad system.
What is in your experience? What sort of complaints? I mean, you say you don't know what they are, but you must hear rumours. What sort of complaints are made?
Well, I should say that the figures they release are about all of staff working in Parliament, so we don't necessarily know these are complaints against MPs. They could be other members of staff, but I would guess a few of them are. And it tends to be, the vast majority tend to be bullying, so it tends to be very kind of intense workloads put on staff, but then augmented by demanding and unreasonable behaviour, which has caused quite bad mental health problems for some people involved, because I think everyone expects working in Parliament to be stressful, but there's a limit to these things. So that's the majority of cases. And then we've also heard about a small minority of sexual harassment cases, which tend to be more serious, but also more difficult to prove. That's kind of what we typically hear about.
And Esther, there's a row, isn't there, this week about MPs appearing via Zoom. Ironically, given the Prime Minister is one of the most prominent. He was at PMQs yesterday for the first time. you can listen to us picking that apart on the Red Box podcast. But what is the latest on the row between MPs and Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Yeah, so in a way, PMQs yesterday was quite a good shop window for the way virtual Parliament has been working. It showed that it is possible to carry on with business while the Prime Minister is self-isolating. But I don't know, your listeners will probably remember that last week, there was a big
it feels like a year.
feels like last year. There was a big outcry about Tracy Crouch, who is a Conservative MP who's being treated for breast cancer at the moment, and she wasn't able to virtually attend and speak in a debate on cancer, which obviously seems mad, because MPs aren't currently allowed to make speeches virtually. They can only ask questions. And Jacob Rees-Mogg has said he's going to change this, which I think everyone has welcomed. But he's only changing it for the extremely vulnerable category. And the MPs are already upset about this. He got quite a hammering, actually, earlier this week from MPs in his own party, some of whom have vulnerable family members, and this won't apply to them. And also they're upset about the fact that it would mean basically people have to declare that they fall into that category. So it's a potential privacy issue as well. So we can see that despite the fact this has gone on for whatever it is, 6 months, 5 years, or however long it feels, Jacob Rees-Mogg hasn't quite got it right yet. So I think this one will run and run.
Just finally, Robert, there's this ongoing, rumbling and increasingly complicated story about the BBC and Diana, Princess of Wales, and her interview with Martin Bashir. Prince William now wading in, saying he thinks that having the investigation into allegations of forgery, deceit and cover-up was at least a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it is a step in the right direction. Another step in the right direction would be not to employ Martin Bashir any longer. I can't understand why he still works there.
It just seems a bit odd, given the bit that I struggle with sometimes is all of the bits are. You know, there's so many parts of this story that by the time you've got all the background in, you haven't got any space for the new line. But I mean, it's basically how Martin Bashir managed to persuade Diana to do that famous Panorama interview.
Yes, it is. Yeah, but through getting a guy to forge telling a whole load of lies about, basically kind of feeding on her paranoia about the rest of the royal family and telling her a lot of lies about her being spied on and so forth, and various kind of tittle-tattle about nannies and so forth. But principally by getting a guy to forge some bank statements, which indicated that people were being paid off, I think, to spy on her. Wholly disreputable. I mean, if he worked for the Times, first of all, he wouldn't do that. But if he had done it, he would be sacked long ago.
Yeah, and probably not invited back as religious affairs editor or whatever. So it's Lord Dyson, who's one of the country's most senior retired judges, has been appointed by the BBC to lead the inquiry. You can read more about it at thetimes.co.uk right now. Robert Crampton and Esther Webber there. Don't forget, you can read them both. They both write for The Times throughout the week. Esther obviously writes the Redbox morning email. You can sign up to The Times right now and go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox, where you can currently get a month free subscription if you sign up right now. Up next, I speak to Sir David Lidington about the rise of military robots.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast now. Boris Johnson's pledged to end Britain's era of retreat with the largest investment in the military since the Cold War and plans for a new space command and artificial intelligence agency. He's announced a four-year funding settlement for the Ministry of Defence worth an extra £16.5 billion. There's lots of talk of cyber wars and space wars and robots, but is it all a good idea? So David Lidington is a former Conservative cabinet minister. He was de facto deputy prime minister to Theresa May. He's now chairman of the Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI as it's known, the world's oldest independent think tank on international defence and security. I've been speaking to him about all this money that Boris Johnson's found for the military, and I began by asking, is it a good idea?
Yes, I think it's a good idea. The reason I'm only slightly hesitant about it is that, of course, what we're not going to get today is the detail of the government's integrated review of our international interests and security needs, and then how defence, as well as other sort of areas of power that we can exercise in the world, contributes to that. And we'll have a clearer idea of the strategic analysis that lies behind today's announcement when the integrated review comes out, which seems likely to be early in the new year. But I know the guys at Number 10 who have been working on the integrated review. These are people like John View who have been serious specialists in security and strategic studies, know the stuff, are not going to have the wool pulled over their eyes by lobbyists from different government departments or outside. We're going to have a hard-headed look at the UK's global interests in the 21st century. So I'm reasonably confident that we'll get the sort of picture we need of the UK's interests, and then how defence and diplomacy and soft power of various kinds all fit into our need to sustain and defend those interests. But today, yeah, it's good news for this reason. We face different challenges. The world is multipolar now. It's not an American hegemony. It's a more dangerous place. We're subject to threats from both potentially hostile states and from non-state actors, from international terrorist groups, from serious and organized criminal networks of various kinds that are every bit as professional as legitimate multinational businesses. And we're dealing with the impact on security, as well as everything else, of new technology, the internet, of AI, of robotics, of miniaturization. And so what our defense services need to do is to beef up our capabilities in those new areas and invest in research and development and then implementation of those capabilities, but not run down our existing assets while we build up those new areas of power and expertise. So when it's this difficult transitional phase where you don't want to let your guard down with what you have already, but you need to spend more to develop the new technologies, and then your emphasis starts to change as the new technologies come on stream. So, yeah, it seems to me that it's a sensible decision, and I hope, too, that it will be a powerful signal to the incoming Biden administration in Washington that the UK takes seriously the American expectation that European countries, including us, will do more to contribute to the security of the transatlantic alliance as a whole.
There's lots of talk about drones and cyber technology and artificial intelligence, rather than sort of tanks and guns and ships, which is the sort of normal thing we expect from defence spending. You know, ministers like to go and point at big grey things that they've spent a lot of money on. So for people listening to this, what are the threats that we face? Where do they come from? And how would they affect listeners' lives?
We face threats from states, from countries like Russia, perhaps in the future from China. I don't think China's not going to attack the United Kingdom, but China's power potentially to disrupt freedom of navigation through oceans that are really important to UK trade, potential risk to our submarine cables that link our telecommunications and our IT systems on which so much of our society depends, and then potentially hostile states, but also very expert professional criminal gangs have increasing interest in cyber power. So we used to think of our critical national infrastructure as things like dams and power plants and so on, physical buildings that you need to defend against attack from land or from the air. Now, so much of our critical infrastructure is about IT systems, that we use systems and robots to control much of our transport arrangements, our health arrangements, our power generation and distribution arrangements. And so we've seen in different parts of the world the impact on the lives of your listeners on Times Radio. If, say, the IT system goes down, suddenly the lights go out. Or suddenly, as when the NHS was subjected to the WannaCry computer virus attack about 3 years ago, suddenly our hospitals stopped being able to operate properly because our NHS workers could not get access to the data about patient records or who was booked for appointments and so on. So cybersecurity is an increasingly important element in our defence arrangements.
And given your time in government, how secure is... I mean, like you said, the NHS one is the most obvious example in recent years. But how secure is the way that government and Whitehall does IT? I mean, you know, we heard, you know, in a slightly different context, but earlier in the summer, the totting up the number of coronavirus cases fell over because they were using an old version of Excel. This doesn't feel like a 21st, you know, a country with 21st century secure IT systems to protect ourselves from those sorts of attacks.
Yeah, and when I was in the Cabinet Office in my last government job, I sort of spent quite a bit of time looking into this. And yes, the British state has lagged too far behind best practice in its own cybersecurity ranges. Now, that is changing. And, for example, the creation of the National Cybersecurity Centre, that's a public-facing offshoot of GCHQ, making their expertise available to both the civil service and local government, but to the private sectors and charities as well, has been really important in helping to drive up standards. I introduced, when I was in government, a new rule that said that we're going to have the main government contractors, the private companies work for government, insisting on a given level of cybersecurity throughout their supply chains in future. We couldn't simply take it on trust. It had to be written into contract. So I think departments in government are raising their game. But, you know, yeah, there's a long tail here. And I think this is something that ministers and permanent secretaries, the civil service bosses, really need to make sure is on their agenda. And in my view, there should be a director on each of the boards that govern the affairs of government departments who is explicitly responsible for cybersecurity matters. You can't any longer separate our international security risks from our domestic security risks. The internet enables criminals and hostile states to act right across national frontiers, to reach into your territory through your exposure in various networks.
And one of the things I was struck at reading the coverage this morning about what the Prime Minister was announcing is if you look at what the public think, YouGov polling asking people about what the government spends money on, a quarter say the government spends too much on defence, that's second only to foreign aid. The Prime Minister's talking today about this is a chance to end the era of retreat. But actually, the year of retreat came after, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, and the British public becoming wary of Britain, you know, getting involved in military conflict and that sort of thing. Mm. So how can the Prime Minister sell this? £16 billion is such a phenomenal amount of money. You know, we're in an economic crisis. Other departments being told that they aren't going to have the money. Why should people think this is a good idea to spend this money? And the risk that this looks a bit like old Britain wants to, you know, start interfering in things around the world again.
Yeah, I think that's why I think it's so important that we get the conclusions of the integrated review of security out as soon as possible, because I think that will provide the evidence and the narrative to set today's defence spending announcement in the broader security policy context and enable us to talk about it as well as diplomacy, as well as information and economic conflicts, as well as development aid and so on. So you see everything in the round. But I think the Prime Minister can make some very powerful points. He can say that the number of threats to us and our interests around the world is increasing. We've seen how North Korea, for example, is developing not just a nuclear weapons program, but very long-range missile delivery systems. And that sort of technology on nuclear, God forbid, but in biological, chemical warfare, we saw what happened in Salisbury 2 years ago, can be transferred by hostile governments or by rogue scientists at the click of a mouse. And so that threat is becoming wider. And we've seen how terrorist groups can pose a threat to us, not only in this country, but in France, Germany, Belgium, Japan, many different parts of the world. Secondly, the Prime Minister will be able to point to how new technologies are transforming the battlefield. If you look at the war in recent weeks between Azerbaijan and Armenia in the South Caucasus, one of the reasons that the Azerbaijanis came out on top quite swiftly was their use of drones to reconnoiter and sort of find out information about the other side's deployments. And when I've talked to people in the services, you know, they have been clear to me that they see drones, they see robots of different types as being essential if the Army, Navy and Air Force are themselves going to keep up with their responsibility to defend us against potential aggressors who themselves are seizing every advantage they can from new technologies. So, and I don't think it's about interfering, you know, ad hoc around the world. I mean, you know, we've got to be realistic about our place in the world. We'll still be a formidable defense power, diplomatic and aid power, an important ally for others. But I think that the reality is that we are going to need to act wherever possible in concert with like-minded countries, both other European democracies and other democracies in different parts of the world, countries like Australia, countries like Japan or South Korea, as well as, of course, the United States. And the United States, you know, with the Biden administration coming in, that will value alliances and will value international institutions, will also want to see its allies doing more. Because what Joe Biden is aware of is that there is a very large section of American opinion that basically thinks European countries like France, the UK, Germany have been freeloading on the American taxpayer for their security for too long and should be doing more. And I think today's announcement is a pretty powerful gesture that we are shouldering our responsibilities.
I just want to ask you, you talked about drones, robots, there's talk of autonomous weapons. If you want to get properly sort of sci-fi about it all, autonomous weapons that sort of think for themselves, is that not incredibly risky? Am I being completely ignorant about what we're talking about here? But once you've got robots that think for themselves and can go around wreaking havoc and, you know, firing weapons, is that not incredibly dangerous?
That is why it is important that if you're developing autonomous weapon systems, you get the technology absolutely right, but also that you have the capacity to think through the ethical element of this. I mean, if you like, there's an analogy perhaps with a sort of more mundane sort of example, which is of autonomous cars, where you know, people are having to wrestle with the question as well, if a self-drive vehicle, you know, sees a pedestrian in their path, you know, do they try to swerve to avoid that person? But what if a car is coming in another direction, or if swerving off is a threat to the driver and passengers in that autonomous vehicle? So those ethical questions occur even more sharply when you're talking about weapon systems. And you know, the soldiers, sailors, and airmen, women who are sort of involved in this get this. And one of the things we do at RUSI, the think tank I chair, is to look at, you know, some of these, the ethical dimension as well as the strategic and the technological dimensions of security policy decisions. These are not easy, but I don't think that these are dilemmas that we can simply say it's too difficult, we're going to have to avoid it. It's how you write the programs, what assumptions do you build into the programs that govern the systems that you have at your disposal.
Just slightly stepping away from defence, three quick sort of more domestic questions. Well, the first one actually is on foreign aid. Lots of talk this week that the Prime Minister's looking to cut foreign aid temporarily, but then, you know, does that end up becoming permanent? What do you think about that? Is that something the government should be thinking, reducing the 0.7% of GDP spent on foreign aid?
I would much prefer we kept to the 0.7%. I mean, I get Rishi Sunak's got an incredibly difficult sort of set of financial problems that he's having to wrestle with in the aftermath of COVID. But the beauty about the 0.7 is that it is self-regulating. If our GDP goes down, as it's going to because of COVID this year, then 0.7 means less cash than the previous year.
Yeah, so it's going down anyway.
Sum spent on development is going down anyway. And I do worry also, if you're going to cut 0.7, not only the message that sends, but then you get on to the question, well, which actual programs do you stop spending on? I don't think anybody would really want to stop vaccination, for example, God forbid, you know, this is the moment with COVID. I'd have thought we want to spend a lot of our development money on getting COVID vaccinations into poor countries because we don't want the disease to become endemic there and then spread from there around the world. We don't want to stop education and health for women and children in Africa or the poorest parts of Asia. So what do you stop? Well, quite a lot of Foreign Office spending on poor countries, a lot of diplomatic work, even some defence work is paid for by what's called Overseas Development Assistance, ODA money, which is what the 0.7% covers. It's more than just the Department for International Development's old budget. So I think if the government were to ask me for advice, I would be saying, look, I think this is a battle not worth fighting. But having said that, I recognise the dilemma that the Chancellor is facing on this, because he's got calls for increased spending on all sides. But you can't just keep piling up debt indefinitely.
OK, two more quick ones. We spent many happy years when you were Europe Minister with you telling me how you were negotiating David Cameron's renegotiated membership of the EU and then subsequently discussing Brexit. All eyes now on Boris Johnson. Is he going to get it? You're still plugged in Europe. Is he going to get a deal in the next week or so?
I'm still in the optimistic camp, think 55-45 that there'll be a deal. My worry is just that you run out of time.
Yeah.
Because it's incredibly complex, and it's if there's a deal, it's said it'll be translated into 23 different languages and then go through ratification in both Brussels and Westminster. So yeah, next week really is crunch time, but while it will be a thinner deal than personally I would have preferred, it is still a lot better than no deal.
Yeah.
Being able to avoid customs charges on all our food exports, all our car exports, our aviation exports. I mean, that would be something worth having.
Just finally then, you've been in government when the Prime Minister's lost two controversial advisers to stage a relaunch. In your time, it was Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill. Theresa May then tried to relaunch us. Any advice for Boris Johnson on what he should do now?
Build up a good new number 10 team as rapidly as possible. Appoint a chief of staff who knows that their job is to give you advice that is 100% candid behind the scenes, even if it's unwelcome. It's really important the PM has people around him who will tell him unwelcome truths, honestly, but then are 100% loyal outside the room and shut up otherwise. And if they become the story, that it's awful for you guys, the media, but it's bad news for the government when the advisors become the story. Secondly, trust your ministers. You appointed them. If you don't like the ministers, you've got to appoint other ones. But actually trust them to get on with the job and hold them accountable for delivery. And as COVID permits, spend more time with your MPs as well, because, you know, that's important for any PM.
That was Sir David Livingston there from the defence think tank, RUSI. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Let us know what you think of it. You can get in touch with me, matt.chorley@times.radio. And don't forget, you can subscribe to The Times right now. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.